freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says? No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
We stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No one!
Well, here we go. Another Brock and Salk podcast, post-draft edition. No more speculation on names. Now we get to speculate on future performance of said names. I appreciated Howdy getting called out for just referring to people as names. But yeah. I kind of know where he's coming from. Like, I get it. Like, well, you're not just going to draft somebody based on their name. Like, okay. Yeah, I see where you're coming from. But really, that's all these guys are. I mean, you know, other than for a select small group who are studying the tape and, you know, they are just names. They are. And that's why draft, you know, instant analysis is bunk generally. Why it's challenging to grade a draft right after it's happened. Because, you know, Bobby Wagner, nobody knew who he was. And Russell Wilson was considered a bad pick. And so there's example after example of guys that were not highly thought of who ended up being great. And vice versa, obviously, the, you know, Jamarcus Russells of the world and plenty of others who were, you know, Aaron Curry and others here who we thought were going to be world beaters who never materialized at all. So when you judge a draft, it's challenging to just, you know, judge the names. What you can judge, I believe, is the strategy behind it, Brock. And I would say overall, I'm disappointed by the strategy that the Seahawks showed off over the weekend. I didn't think it was well thought out. I thought that it got away from, you know, we always talk about the game speeding up on you. I wasn't in the draft room. I don't know what was going through John Schneider's head. I don't know any of that personally. But the sense I got watching it from the outside is that when they weren't able to trade back on day one, that after that, the draft just got away from them. That everything they wanted to do, they weren't fully able to accomplish. That it was all based on, okay, we trade out of 27, we pick up an extra pick in the third or fourth, and that allows us to do A, B, C, D, and E through the rest of the draft. And when that strategy was taken away from them by Green Bay deciding they got a better deal elsewhere, it just felt, I was saying this to Tom, Jake, and Stacey the other day, if you've ever done fantasy drafts, and I don't do them anymore, I haven't played fantasy in a decade, but I remember doing, especially in baseball, fantasy drafts, and you go into it with a plan and something screws it up and I'm not good enough at it and I didn't pay enough attention. Next thing you know, you're like, God, I hate my team. I didn't even mean to draft any of these guys. Like, I mean,
congratulations to me. I got the best second. I got Chase Utley in the mid-2000s.
Right.
But, man, I missed out on every shortstop, on every outfielder, on every ace. Ugh.
How did I end up with this team? This was not the team I was. Oh, I know why. Because I didn't think someone was going to take David Wright with the 13th pick. And the next thing you know, that's what I was built. I don't know that that's what happened to the Seahawks over the weekend. But just watching them go, linebacker seems to be a bit of a reach, even by their own words, a bit of a reach. You know, edge rusher who was not part of the top tier, guard. Just, you kind of go through it. It just didn't feel right.
Well, a couple things. I use the word perplexing after the draft and kind of in the heat of it. And I'll kind of stick with that word. That was an emotional reaction then. And 72 hours later to digest it, it is still a bit perplexing. I've done a fair amount of work to try to kind of dig into their philosophy on it. And I think I've got a pretty strong opinion. But you mentioned names, Mike, and I can't go any further here. I mean, it was 42 years ago on this day that Michael Patrick Salk came into the world.
I'm Jewish.
I mean, that name was...
Yes.
That
not
name
like a big
was
Jewish a... name, but okay, thanks. Yeah, Patrick. We'll go with
that
Patrick
name today. Was established on this day 42 years ago.
True.
So happiest of happy 42. It's a great number.
Thanks, buddy.
As a numerology guy, as you are, this is Jackie Robinson's number. This is Lano Hill's number. I think this is 42 is right. a powerhouse age, powerhouse number.
Yep.
You're kind of coming into your own in many ways, probably at the halfway point of your journey.
Oh, thanks.
You know, I mean, usually 84 is, you know, a pretty strong life. So congratulations. Right. Happy, happy, happy birthday.
Thank you. It feels like just yesterday I was miserable about turning 40, and somehow I don't even remember turning 41, and here we are at 42. So things are
you won't remember, man.
Talk about things getting away from you. Talk about things getting away from you. I can sympathize with the Seahawks. I feel like this whole birthday age thing has gotten away from me in the last few years, wearing my reading glasses to do anything. I have to get a new phone, and I was having this debate about the iPhone 11 or the Pro. I was like, well, the 11's bigger, so I can see it better. On the other hand, the Pro has a little bit better screen, so maybe the clarity will help me better.
I'm going to get you one of those giant remote controls with the buttons that are the size of eyeballs, so you can just actually press the buttons.
My buddy Nate, of course, I was texting him about it, and he's like, dude, just use the bigger font. I'm like, I can't use the old man font. I'm avoiding that. I'm not using the old man font. I just moved the phone farther away from my face. It's terrible. Yep. It's just awful. So there you go. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for bringing it up.
Well, happy birthday. Seriously, it's pretty cool. We get to do a podcast taping on your actual birthday. So, and you got great plans for the rest of the day, and you had a great idea to get into some takeaways and tidbits, which I'm excited to do so, and potpourri and answer some questions. So what a day. What a 42nd birthday.
Let's get to our draft takeaways.
Takeaways.
Number one for me, Mike, you talked about philosophy, right, and trying to dig into it. And I don't know if I can totally disagree with your thesis there that the game just sped up. But when I look at this crew, this looks like a draft where they said the year prior, lots of production. A lot of college players that were very productive players. Gary Jennings, Cody Barton, Phil Haynes, Ugo Amadi, Ben Burkervin, Marquise Blair. Productive players. This year felt like projection. In nearly every pick, it felt like we can project this guy and this talent into our system in the years to come, maybe not for 2020, but as a project or a projection, we love what they bring to the table. Oh, Kobe Parkinson is so tall, and Steven Sullivan is so fast, and Freddie Swain is so twitchy, and Alton Robinson checks so many boxes, and Daryl Taylor is built of granite, and there were so many things on paper to like about a bunch of these picks, but to me, so many of them were in our projection guys because they've not been highly productive in college. Jordan Brooks, absolutely. And probably my favorite pick of the eight. 400 tackles, second team All-American, All-Conference, best player on his team at Texas Tech. You know, he runs, he hits, he fits and fills a big void in that way because he's real fast and he loves to hit. So that's probably my favorite. Daryl Taylor, who they came up to get at 48, you realize at 11 of his 18 and a half sacks, 5 years at Tennessee, redshirted, 5 years, 18 and a half sacks, 11 of those came against the likes of Southern Miss, UAB, Kentucky, and Vanderbilt. So 7.5 sacks outside of that in conference over 4 years at Tennessee. I mean, just not a whole lot of production. Alton Robinson this year, this last year, left school as a true junior. Well, he left school, right, because he was dominant, because he had an amazing year, because he built on a pretty good sophomore year. Well, there were actually 8 games this year that he didn't register a single sack. And his 4 sacks came against Liberty, Western Michigan, Duke, and Wake Forest. So now he's, you know, a lot twitchier and a lot faster than Bradley and I. And, man, he's body beautiful. And he looks the part. And he checks a bunch of boxes. But I think that's why I said to begin, if this was a perplexing draft. Because this felt like so much projection. After a year ago, kind of switching gears to what I like, I like to see college players, Mike, that are the best players on their team. Because usually the best players on their team in college or in high school or in the minor leagues or, you know, you just kind of go, that's the guy that I want playing on my baseball team, on my basketball team, on my football team.
And that's who Jordan Brooks is, right?
That's exactly what Jordan Brooks is. He is by far the most productive of all of these guys. Kobe Parkinson had some production. Damian Lewis, I would say, is kind of a mix. He was a JUCO guy. He's kind of like James Carpenter was a few years ago from Bama, right? Really good line, really good team. You know, junior college the first couple years became, you know, Damian Lewis was second team All-SEC this year. But, I mean, a good player on the best O-line in college football, kind of like Carpenter was at Alabama for those years. A good player on a great offensive line. So he's kind of a mix. You know, he definitely has some production, but it just, man, and what else got me was it's so many places they could have got really productive players. Like, they picked right there with the Baltimore Ravens. It was awesome. You see the Ravens, like, draft philosophy and DaCosta and Harbaugh, and even though DaCosta's, you know, filled in for Ozzie Newsome, it's the same DNA. It's, yeah, man, we want Ravens. We want good players, you know, and Hawks
we
go Jordan
Tony
Brooks.
Banks. We don't want Brock Heward. That's right. We want a Tony Banks, not
that's
Brock
it. Well, that, yeah. Yeah, that was more Billick.
But yeah, still, it's a Ravens along those philosophy. Lines. Yes. You got to like that philosophy. Yeah.
You do. So that's where it was perplexing for me, because just in a bunch of spots, Matabuike's there, Devin Duvernay's there, not just because these are names that I know, but those dudes were just good players, productive players. May not check every box like Daryl Taylor does on the scouting sheet, or Colby Parkinson, or Alton Robinson, or even, you know, Freddie Swain that's hyper-athletic, but Freddie Swain had 68 catches in 4 years at Florida. 68 and 4. Devin Duvernay, granted much higher pick, had 105 last year alone. So I just kind of scratch my head at so much of that projection.
Takeaways.
I said it was a disappointing draft. I try to start positively. I like the Jordan Brooks pick a lot. I mean, that's probably the one that in some ways got panned the most. But I like it. I think there's a lot that makes sense. It's a little outside the box.
Yeah.
But he seems like what I didn't know necessarily that they needed, but that I could see why they believed it. I'm hoping he allows Bobby Wagner to be Bobby Wagner this year. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Right? I think he's a good short-term pickup. He's a good long-term pickup. He allows them to do what you need to do with KJ Wright, whether it's to cut him, restructure him, move him to a different position if he's going to become more of a strong side guy, and that ultimately he's either a successor to KJ or to Bobby. That's good value out of your first-round pick. I like that. Yep. I understand why other people didn't, and I understand that they would have preferred to have gotten him 5, 6, 7 picks later than they actually did.
Yep.
But you can't force somebody to trade with you if there's no trade partner available. You've got to make a pick at 27. And I think they did the right thing with Jordan Brooks. Now, we'll wait and see whether he lives up to that. I can't tell you whether Brooks is a better player than Queen or any other inside linebacker in that spot. But even though it wasn't considered a position of need, I think when you start talking through it, it makes a lot of sense. And especially when you look at the NFC West, where all of those teams have strong running games, screen game, tight ends for days, right? A linebacker who can run and hit, I think, has some really big value for this.
Well, they're playing in space. The Rams play in space. The Niners get Deebo Samuel in space. Arizona's whole system is built on getting guys in space.
So if you can get somebody fast who can hit,
correct.
I mean, that seems awfully important. And you know, we talked last week about Bobby, you know, letting Bobby eat and not having enough around him. Maybe this gives him more. Maybe not in year one, but over time, you know, maybe having somebody else with some real speed who can cover as KJ starts to lose a step or two here. You know, that seems like a pretty big positive for the Seahawks. So I like what they did with Jordan Brooks. I'll say I kind of like the Alton Robinson pick, just because getting a DN in that spot, and I don't know, just watching some of the film of him, he looks like the kind of player that you would want. And those are really the two that I look at with, you know, satisfaction.
Well, you're drafted in the fifth round, too. You're not looking for the best player in the draft.
That's
in
right.
The fifth round. You're looking for a guy that could become something more than you think that most teams think he is. So no problem there.
Those are kind of the two that stood out to me in a positive.
Takeaways.
DJ Dallas, Colby Parkinson, Damian Lewis. Howdy, I got some talking to you to do in one of my other little takeaways or tidbits. So you got to be very, very careful how much
you're going to. You're up, man. Takeaway away.
DJ Dallas was just an average player at Miami. I mean, he was just, you know, I don't see a plus trait. There's not plus size. There's not plus speed. They say he was a really wonderful pass blocker. Well, tell me, the Seahawks are going to throw it 40 times a game. Right? I mean, he split reps with Travis Homer, and Travis Homer's a third back in this league. So I struggle with that one. Colby Parkinson can't get his pads
down. It's not just that he's a third
block.
Back. It seems like those guys play the same position.
Homer and him?
Yeah, I mean, I know they both play running back, but it seems like they're both third down back.
Yes. Yeah, maybe. Yes.
What am I missing?
Yes.
Why do you need two third down backs?
Because Travis Homer's not very good, and he's too small, and you watched that all last year, and he's
right.
out.
Fine. If you're saying, okay, we don't like what we had with Homer, and we just needed to upgrade it, fine. But he's a third down back. I mean, you're like, I don't know. It seems like a third down back whose best strength is blocking is what Travis Homer is.
Yeah. Yeah. Colby Parkinson in the fourth round. You know, super athletic dude, man. Southern California guy. I probably saw him, I don't know, 6 times in college. Intriguing guy. Super lengthy and huge catching radius. He's made some big time catches. Is a, you know, doesn't run particularly well, and certainly can't get his pads down and block. So if you're going to be a run-blocking heavy team in that way, then where he is the 20-yard line and in, right? I mean, he's just, or 35-yard line and in. He's a vertical seam guy or a corner route guy.
He's just a bigger Jacob Hollister.
that you isolate. Yeah, yeah, probably a much longer Jacob Hollister, lesser blocker, even a lesser blocker.
I mean, Hollister didn't do much in blocking, right? He's not an inline tight end. He's more of that split tight end type thing. And all right, yep. I mean, if Parkinson can take that role but not be small.
Yeah,
because I think that's Hollister's everything about him I like. He's just not big enough. That guy gets wrecked.
And if you can find a way to move on from the $3 million you're now committed to paying Jacob Hollister
the Seahawks season comes down to Jacob Hollister being too small. And that's not a shot. I love the way that guy played this year. He had some huge catches for the Seahawks. And I hope he makes the team because he's a production guy. He finds ways to produce. If Jacob Hollister is Colby Parkinson's size, does he get stopped at the goal line in week 17?
No way. There's no way.
Probably not. Yeah, probably not.
He gets in. The Seahawks score a touchdown. They get a first-round bye. And who the heck knows what happens after that?
Yeah. Now, Damian Lewis and Daryl Taylor, these are going to be a little just, you know, harder for me to try to swallow. Now, we saw over the weekend, the Lewis makes a little more sense as they, you know, cut Fluker, who, by the way, signs immediately with the Baltimore Ravens, whereas Ifedi had to wait, you know, a long, long time. But, you know, he's a perfect fit, is Fluke, in Baltimore. I don't think he had 10 other options, but good for Fluke, and I love that guy, and you're going to miss his spirit. So, you know, this starts to make a little bit more sense, but, you know, there's Phil Haynes, who you drafted in the fourth round last year, who you loved, right? I mean, that big old back, the guy that was, you know, you plugged in before they decided to have sports hernia surgery on him. He was running with the ones at times in the offseason, right? You loved him 1 year ago in the fourth round. There's Jamarco Jones, who handled Aaron Donald to a degree and played guard at a pretty high level, right? I mean, those guys are there. Ethan Posick is still on the roster. You signed back Mike Iupati. I mean, you got some guys, Iupati, you got some big bodies in there that you already like. And that was a sweet spot, man. Both Taylor and Lewis are in the swing. It's like when that pitcher misses. That's the spinning slider in this draft, right in the heart of the zone, right? That 48 to 60 to 70, they're starters. They're going to be Pro Bowlers that are going to be found in that mix in this draft, be it receiver, be it running back. There are some dynamic dudes. And you went, you know, with a project in Taylor and with a powerful man in Damian Lewis at a position where you had 18 dudes on your line.
Brock, you don't even need to say one name. The heart of this draft was the second and third round. The Seahawks entered the draft with 2 second round picks and a third. They finished the draft with 1 second and a third. I mean, like, I don't know what else you need to know. That, to me, if you're looking for reasons why I'm not wild about what they did over the weekend, the sweet spot of the draft was the second and, to a lesser extent, third round. They started the draft with more picks there than they finished with.
Correct.
That's not the way I wanted nor expected the draft to go.
Agreed.
And I think that's one of those things where you just have to wait and see and let them be accountable for it.
Tidbits.
All right, I got a tidbit, Rob. Yes. Tidbit. Everyone is raving about Cliff Kingsbury's house. Right. Oh, I've heard Cliff Kingsbury wins the draft. Look at his GQ house. That's the coolest house ever. Look at Cliff Kingsbury, Mr. Cool. People understand that house is in Phoenix, right? That house costs less than your car. Every house in Phoenix.
No,
it
does.
That's like an $150,000 house.
No.
Brock drives a $200,000 car.
No.
Your car, Brock, costs more than Cliff Kingsbury's cool little living room.
That's
it's Phoenix.
$3 million house.
No, it is not.
Yes, it is.
It is in Phoenix. That house costs nothing. They give when you move to Phoenix, they give those houses away.
No, Brock,
don't argue with me.
It's not in White Center.
I know.
It's not in White Center. It's in a suburb.
Everything in Phoenix looks like that. You're not talking about the coolest thing. Yeah, if you had that in Seattle, you'd be like, whoa. You bought paid money for land and built this brand new house. Like, everything in Arizona is new. The whole city's only been there for like 3 years. Don't fool yourself into thinking Cliff Kingsbury's got class or taste or, you know, he's this cool yuppie dude. No, none of that is true. That's just what they have in Phoenix. My idiot friend Joel has a house like that. Joel barely works. Rocket, don't be fooled. That is a most important tidbit I wanted to get to from this draft.
takeaways.
My next tidbit, I think, is going to be decent along those lines. No, that's a pretty hot take. That's a pretty hot little tidbit.
Not a hot take. Hot city. I mean, it's really warm there, but that's not a hot take. You've been there with me. That place he lives in is next to a Chili's. And on the other side of it is a Golden Corral. Like, don't be fooled. That is not like a fancy pad.
Tidbits.
You are a beauty.
Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Brock.
Well, tidbit or takeaway. Let me give you a takeaway. Play the takeaway one, because I don't know if you're going to agree to disagree with this one or not. And you and I, unfortunately, I think, saw this draft for the Seahawks in a little similar vein, which is kind of portrayed as a negative. So let me actually spin it positive and say it felt like, in covering this draft both Thursday and Friday and talking through all the first picks for 12 hours, it feels like, for better or worse, the NFL is getting a lot smarter. That the NFL, like Major League Baseball and their front offices, have flattened the dummy curve, right? It has eliminated the Al Davises and the Jerry Jones and the Glazer family and others to come in and hijack a draft room and say, this is what we're going to do. Like Major League Baseball, they've employed a lot of statisticians. Like Major League Baseball, they've gotten younger. Mm-hmm. The number of times Molly said, like, who is that? How old is that? Is he a coach? No, that's the GM. And then you see the coach be it Kingsbury or McVay or the guy up in Green Bay. I mean, they all look 25. Yeah. I mean, but they're just younger. They're pretty slick. This whole virtual world was no problem to the majority of them. And, through three rounds, there just wasn't those Darius Hayward Bays. There wasn't those... Did they just draft the wrong guy with the same name as the other player?
I thought there was one bad pick in the first round. Where I was like, that's not going to work out. And that was Justin Herbert.
Oh.
I mean, I don't think he's any good. Oh. But other than that, I didn't think there was...
I didn't love the Raiders taking Henry Ruggs just because he was fast as the first wide receiver.
Oh, I think Henry Ruggs is pretty good. I mean, look, you can quibble with some of them. You're like, okay, this guy might be better than that. I'm not saying that all those players are going to work out. But as I watched, there wasn't one I was like, oof, that's not going to work out.
Right.
I mean, I think I agree with you 100%. They are getting smarter. And if you're looking for evidence of that, look no farther than the fact that round 4, pick 16, was Jacob Eason.
Correct.
Smart GMs passed on that guy 3.5 times before finally saying, like, all right, the arm's big enough. He's a backup. Fine. Maybe we can get something out of him one day. Jacob Eason's not very good.
Yeah.
He was not very good in college, and he's not going to be very good in the pros. And a couple of years ago, Howdy would have been right. He would have been a first-round pick. And now he's a fourth-round pick because NFL teams have wisened up to the fact that their players should be good instead of pretty.
Yeah, we were chatting about this a bunch. It was kind of fun on Friday. I did a little bit of draft work with Mark Dominic. Remember, we used to have him on our show. Smart
little
dude,
Tampa
former
Bay, GM,
GM in Tampa for a bunch of years. He shared a cool story about a player they had that he and the coach loved, and they were going to take him pretty high. And the owner, Glazer, was like, "Yeah, we're not taking him. Like he can't talk." Like, there's just no, I mean, we're just not doing that. It's just, we can't take him that high. And the GM and coach, and Mark's like, if I had more spine and more background and, could have just peppered him with even more intel and more information, maybe. But he's like, I didn't have the spine. And we take a different guy that was nowhere near the player. And, I just think you're seeing less of that. And I will say this, too. I think this format also, helped these guys. There wasn't paralysis by analysis. There wasn't like a multiple choice question. It's like, okay, everybody got this? Like, you're not all sitting in that room day after day after day and groupthink comes in. Like, nope, this is what we're doing. There's a process to it, separating some of the emotion. We're separated as people here. We're all doing our work. And yeah, man, for better or worse, it just felt smarter. Even Bill O'Brien,
agreed,
who butchered, I thought, a lot of the offseason moves and trades, I even thought he drafted fairly well. So, yeah, the league, like its peers in Major League Baseball, I think is getting smarter overall.
Takeaways.
Well, I'll give you this one. You mentioned Britt and Fluker, and I guess this is sort of post-draft, but it fits right in there. Yeah, that helps you look at the draft a little bit more positively, because I'll say the Damian Lewis pick is probably the one that bummed me out the most, and I'll admit I'm colored a little bit by the immediate description of him on ESPN, which was to praise the offensive line he was in rather than the player. And you mentioned James Carpenter earlier. That was exactly where my mind went. When they drafted him and I went, really? Okay, well, who is he? Is he a big mauler and a tough guy and a nasty leader of the pack? No, the immediate comment, and again, I'm colored by what I see on television. The immediate comment is, well, he was part of a really good offensive line at LSU. Okay, was he the reason the offensive line was good at LSU? Was he the leader of the offensive line at LSU? Was he the guy that Ed Orgeron would say, Brock, to answer your question, he's the one I'd want in a dark alley with me at night because he's so tough? No, he's just part of a really good offensive line. Now, he may end up being good, all right? Again, I don't know the player from Adam, and I certainly don't have the ability to judge an offensive guard based on three or four highlights that I watch on television. So I'm not going to pretend like I know what's going to happen. But when you see it and hear that, it was just, it felt so reminiscent of Carpenter. There's just like, ugh, this is a major pick. This is, again, the sweet spot of the draft, the third round.
69th overall.
You've been waiting for this one, and there's some really good players still on the board. I don't know, that one was tough, so we can talk more about him. But, yeah, look, when you're removing Fluker and Britt, it starts to make a little more sense why you'd want a guard, although it still keeps you at 17 offensive linemen, which seems like overkill. I found myself thinking yesterday about Fluker and Britt. Imagine two more different person. DJ Fluker gets cut, and I think everyone who ever thinks that people in the media just make their comments based on personality, DJ Fluker gets cut, and I was like, yep, okay, that makes sense. He's done here. Like, he kind of did what he needed to do for a couple of years, but I absolutely see why they believe they needed to move on. And I say that despite he's probably top five interview we've done, and I don't think we're alone. I mean, all the shows on the station feel the same way. You saw the outpouring from all the writers. He's just a good dude, a genuine, awesome, nice guy to deal with, who's pleasant and fun, and you root for him, and he's humble, and he's so huge. He gave me that hug, which was so funny. Like, I mean, how do you not root for DJ Fluker? That doesn't mean you think he's got to stay on the team. You understand that it's time for them to move on and do something else, but hey, good for him. He's here, and he was here, and I'll miss him. How about the fact that he wants to stay in the Northwest even after moving on? That's great.
Yeah.
Justin Britt was not a very good player for very long, and I got to tell you, I disliked dealing with him as much as anybody we've ever had, any player ever. Surly, sullen, rude, I mean, and for no reason. And by the way, those things would all be fine. Like, okay, he's an offensive lineman. He wants to be sully and sullen, and, you know, rude and nasty. Okay, fine. He's gonna be so good on the field because that's his mentality. He stunk. Justin Britt was terrible.
He had one good year.
Yes, he was.
As a center, he was
He had one
terrible.
Good year as a center.
He had one good year.
He was terrible as a tackle. He was bad as a guard. They moved him to center. He had a good year. He got paid off that year and was never good again. Yeah. And then he started getting hurt. Justin Britt has been a waste of their time every year he's been here, except for one. And so take that into account. Take into account that he was just nasty to deal with, and not in like, oh, cool guy offensive lineman, he's nasty, but guess what? He's just talking on the field. No, he didn't do that either. Thank God. Good riddance to Justin Britt. I couldn't be happier that he's gone. I'm going to miss DJ Fluker, even though I'm fine with it, and I understand why they did what they did. And so hopefully Damian Lewis is better than my initial impression.
Okay, help me on this, because I'm going to circle back to a little bit just philosophically of where we started. And
tidbits.
No, this is a huge takeaway. I'm not ready. I got a tidbit. Right. I'll tell you when I'm ready for a tidbit.
Takeaways.
So, to me, and I'm just kind of trying to work this out loud with you, Salk. You're an out loud speaker. You like this stuff. That's why you're so excellent on radio. Is it possible the Seahawks really believe in their personnel so much more than any of us do, and that is why they took projection?
No, but there's a better explanation for that.
Oh, you don't think so? You don't think that they like still Lano Hill and Marquise Blair and
some of them, yes. I don't think it's possible that they like Lano Hill. Okay. Let's just be clear. I know you said 42 is my birthday and it's his number. Yeah. I want to be very clear. I don't think it's possible that they like Lano Hill more than we do. I mean, I guess more than we do, yes. But okay. I don't think it's possible that they believe in Lano Hill or anything like that. But I do think that they took a lot of projection long-term guys. But I have to come back to what Pete said last week. And that's that with this year's limited offseason, that the effectiveness of this rookie class to step in right away is going to be limited. that he compared it back to the lockout year. And if you remember that, that was the year of Carpenter and Moffitt and some other guys. And somebody asked him at the press conference, were those guys limited in their ability to have an offseason? Yes, they were. It affected their transition to the pros in year one. So if you take that as the background for what Pete was thinking heading into the draft, it makes perfect sense that for the most part, they didn't draft guys that they expect to come in right away and contribute. They drafted guys that have longer-term projection and projects attached to them because you may not be able to get guys in here right away who can play on any team. It's not just limited to Seattle. That they're banking on that being true of the league in general.
Okay. So then you know what your peer did, a couple of your peers in the NFC that I think have pretty dynamic rosters, and they showed that playing against you last year, one of which was minus Drew Brees, and that was the New Orleans Saints in their roster that came into your house and beat you in your own building, on top of the 49ers, who ultimately won the NFC and dominated for much of the season. The Saints and the 49ers, to that point, Mike, both said then, okay, then we are going to make other trades, and we are going to trade for Trent Williams, and we're going to trade for NFL-ready guys, and then we are actually going to trade away our third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and we are going to get the two guys that we really want that are going to come in and play for us this year. Brandon Ayuk, the wide receiver, Javon Kinlaw, the defensive tackle. The New Orleans Saints, in much the same way, said, you know, forget this. You know, we'll trade away the bottom half of our draft, and we're going to then just really pinpoint and say, these two or three guys in this, you know, wacky offseason are good enough to come in here and help bolster our roster and our team and give us just a little bit extra juice so that we can catch the 49ers. Yep. And if I'm Russell Wilson, or, you know, I'm Pete Carroll, or I'm, you know, theirs, and Bobby Wagner, right now I'm in my 30s, and, like, I don't want to be knocked out of the first round of the playoffs. I want to win a Super Bowl. Did you do enough with this draft class to add to it to bolster your roster? Have you done enough over the last 3 months of free agency to bolster your roster enough to go toe-to-toe with New Orleans, to go toe-to-toe with San Francisco, heck, to go toe-to-toe with Green Bay, who beat you in the playoffs? Like,
I think that's absolutely the problem. The problem isn't their draft. I don't love their draft, but that's not the problem. The problem is they didn't do jack squat leading into it.
They put all of their chips onto the draft after not getting any elite talent in free agency, and then said, okay, now we got the draft. And they came out of the draft without elite talent at all the positions they needed.
It's bizarre. Now, look, we're saying this. They've cleared a whole bunch of money,
yes.
And you know, my assumption is they're going to get Clowney.
They are
somebody
not
like
done.
That.
They're not
right.
done.
So they're not done. So this thing isn't over yet. You don't just cut those guys now without some corresponding move being expected. So, going to reserve a little bit of judgment.
Yes.
But I totally agree with what you said. If you're saying out loud that you believe the draft this year is going to be more, you know, for guys that will contribute starting in 2021 more than 2020, then you needed to act accordingly in free agency in the trade market. You had to. You have Russell Wilson in his prime. And it's not at the beginning of his prime. He's in the middle of his prime.
Yep.
So, what are you doing?
Yep.
Takeaways.
I think it's a fair question. What you're doing is you better sign Jadeveon Clowney now. Like you better, and I think I take him over Everson Griffin because I think there's a lot more known. And, you know, there's going to be more than likely a very limited offseason again, if any, and few mini camps and everything else. So, which could actually benefit Clowney and that body and the healing and everything else to get it done. Get that deal done with him. And I think you and me and a lot of folks feel a whole lot better about them. Okay, play the tidbit thing, Howdy.
Tidbits.
Okay, I'm going to go back-to-back tidbit. I'm going to do it. Okay.
You mentioned tidbits.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned Cliff Kingsbury's house earlier. How lonely did Pete Carroll look in his big house?
So lonely.
Where were his kids? Where was?
Well, they don't live with him anymore. They're all social distance from him.
They're old,
and he's very, very old. He's incredibly susceptible.
Okay.
He's incredibly old.
That's not right. But Pete is, you know, taking it seriously. He's socially distanced.
Yes.
Right. I mean, John's with his family. He's got younger kids, so they're all together. Pete's kids are all.
Then where's
out of the
Pete's
house.
Grandkids? For crying out loud!
They can't be there either. They're with their adult kids.
Right.
In their own houses. They can't be with him. He's
okay,
too old.
Fine. It was just hard. You see all these other kids everywhere and grandkids.
Belichick had that problem, which is why he has his dog. Belichick was the star of the draft.
Stole the draft with his giant old school 1970s checkered table that for some reason was an 8x8 foot table. Did he ever have people over to his house to have a meal? Absolutely not.
Well,
but for some reason he has a giant table.
That's on Nantucket. That's not his normal house. He's definitely a Nantucket.
All the same, there's no reason to have that giant 1970s checkered table.
Awesome.
And
okay.
Then to put his dog in the chair so people wouldn't look at him. By the way, how about that NFL rule that they had those cameras to watch the GMs to make sure that there was nobody else around them all
Not
the time? Yeah, Belichick just with the giant middle finger to the NFL. You can watch my dog on this channel. Thank you very much. No
did
thanks.
Did you see when Belichick had the Patriots logo taped over?
Like, so then Apple didn't
cutout?
Get
yes.
Yeah, Apple didn't get anything published.
You could just like the league is like, hey, you can't have an Apple. Okay, put some Patriots thing over it. All right, it's like he might as well have written out the word Patriots in pen, stuck it on a piece of on a post-it, and stuck it over the computer. I mean, I saw somebody saying, is it possible Belichick's been funny all along? Yes. If you think Belichick is not entertaining, you're missing the boat. Honestly, you are missing the boat. Belichick's press conferences are entertaining. You just have to view them that way and not as an attempt to get information from a coach. You've got to remember that they are an entertainment exercise in how to avoid answering the questions he doesn't want to answer. And once you take them that way, they're hysterical.
So Tidbits.
Yep, thank you. Pete looked really lonely.
Yeah.
The one, and I know that Kyle Brown noticed this, and I know Kyle's not with us today, but if he was, I know that he noticed this. Did John Harbaugh's birdhouses?
Yes.
He's
lining the top of his entry doorway to his downstairs den. He had 7 different birdhouses, not themed, all lined up over the top of his entryway to his den.
Yes.
What kind of a thing is that? Like indoor birdhouses?
It was bizarre.
They're not like ones that his kids made for him.
No.
They're like ones that he purchased off of Etsy and then lined up on the top of his entryway just so that he conceivably could go and look at these birdhouses as he enters and exits the room.
It was amazing.
What kind of a freak show does that?
That's
ridiculous.
But back to Pete being lonely, Salk, it struck me and why over the last decade, your relationship with him more than any other, I think, single individual in Seattle, from where it started to where it ended, grew the most, is because Pete, this has got to be killing him. Like, I think you said in the first podcast when this started, you're like, this is killing me. I'm sorry. I hate this. I hate it. I don't get human interaction. I don't get to talk out loud. I don't get to da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, that is Pete. Pete is so lonely right now. He is so miserable. And when he got on the Zoom calls with the media before and after, he just kept going. Like,
you guys have anywhere else to be?
No.
Hang out. You guys don't want to leave, do you? Come on, we'll hang out. It's fine. Yeah.
And speaking of talking, okay, Howdy did it. Howdy broke 2 media members whose names will remain anonymous.
What do you mean he broke them?
He broke them.
Broke their spirits?
One of them called me and said, I am done. I can't do it anymore. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I can't. I had to mute him. On Twitter, I had to mute him. I love him, but I can't do it anymore. I'm done with him. He is killing me. He's driving me crazy. He's tweeting about this draft, about these prospects. I am done with him. And then I'm going to put my readers on, and I will read you a text from a different media member, Howdy, who said, is Boy Howdy for real? Or is he told to tweet the dumbest, most controversial things he possibly can? He's actually irritating and comes off as an expert. So I feel I need to slap him down. Howdy, you did it, bro. You broke a couple local media members with your hot draft takes.
You know, Brock, I think it's difficult for people to think that there are things that could go wrong in the world. And that the Seahawks could potentially make bad decisions. And that maybe the franchise who has had one of their last 7 first picks in the draft actually become an enviable asset in the league compared to pretty much every other team may not actually be that good at drafting. And so when it's unfolding...
Who was it, Brock? Who was it?
I am not saying
who was it?
No.
You don't need to reveal the names. It's pretty obvious who they are.
No chance. I am not saying it, but I was deeply entertained back-to-back days to get that phone call and that text. And I said, Howdy, you are a rebel rouser. Way to go, buddy.
Takeaways.
Mine is Howdy related, because I'll stand with Howdy for a moment.
Okay.
Wide receiver was not the Seahawks' biggest need. They got a pretty good wide receiver group right now. But this was the best wide receiver draft, maybe in history. Certainly the deepest, right? How many good wide receivers are supposed to come out of this draft? Like 20?
Yep.
For them to get one guy late in the game with very little productivity. That's Freddie Swain. Just felt like a waste of an opportunity. And maybe he'll end up being the best of the bunch. Maybe he's the Doug Baldwin who just shines as a... I don't know. I've never watched Freddie Swain play. But it seemed today like a missed opportunity to add somebody in a draft class that was so deep at such a big position. And not that it was one of need, but it certainly wasn't one of depth. Do you know what I mean? Like, they didn't need it, but if you got it, like, it wouldn't be necessarily a problem. And to get that guy as late as they did, and it just didn't seem right.
Well, because if you want to get an elite talent at wide receiver in future drafts, you're probably going to have to spend a first-round pick on that stuff. That's where this part became really difficult for me watching this draft unfold for the Seahawks and them trading out of the second round, drafting an offensive lineman in the early third. Like, this was your chance to get a potential first-round talent at wide receiver in the second and third round when you didn't have to give up all that much, and you passed on it. You kicked the can down the curb. It's, I don't understand why they did it.
Yes. So, Saul, you like the Seahawks wide receiver room.
Yeah.
So, right now, going into next year.
I'm comfortable.
Lay it out for me. Who do you got? Who are your five receivers you're keeping?
Well, I'm going to keep Lockett. I'm going to keep DK, obviously. Those two guys are going to be the crucial part of it. I mean, after that, you know, there's sort of a toss-up group amongst them. But
Philip Dorsett.
Yeah, I mean, Jerron Brown's gone, right?
Yep, to worry he's
about
out.
Him anymore. I mean, you know.
David Moore. John Ursua, who got one pass last season.
All right, but as a rookie, and I see some projectability. I mean, like, I'm fine with that group. But as I said, it could have gotten better. Yep. It's not a position of great strength for them. But having Lockett and Metcalf at the top of that group, I think, makes them a good wide receiver group, and you're looking for it to get better. And it could have been, and for whatever
reason,
they kind of
didn't choose. You had a historic group.
Yeah, how do you not be a part of that group?
I don't know. And then the one you get, and there were still some receivers there in the second, sixth, and seventh round that had a ton of production. One of the most talented, you know, just productive kids in college football was there, Prochet out of SMU. And you're like, he runs 4.6, so he's not good enough.
KJ Hill at Ohio State set Ohio State's pass receiving record in his career, and they passed on him.
But he runs 4.6, so, you know, he's not good enough. Give me the guy that runs 4.4 that's got the body type we like, or give me KJ Hill that's just a football player. Right? I mean, at some point in these late, and this is one of Howdy's points and has been for years and years and years. And, you know, even Mark Dominic said, hey, this is the way we always viewed it, right, wrong, and he's out of a job, so you can use your own judgment. But he's like, first, second round, you should absolutely find starters, and, you know, those are your chance to find Pro Bowlers, and hopefully, if you hit it right, all pros and you know, generational guys. Those are first, second round picks. Third round should absolutely be starters, you know, can still develop into Pro Bowl guys. Fourth round's where you take risk in his mind. Like, you know, we're going to take some risk there because there's probably somebody with an attribute that's pretty unique, but some others that you know, weigh him down to the fourth round. And then his mind, fifth, sixth, and seventh with special teams. Like, you know, how can we find a role for that guy on our team and on the special teams, and where can he be a monster? And that was kind of the way that he viewed it, and I'm sure a bunch of people do. I just wonder at some point, as I look at these sixth and seventh round picks, Howdy, right? And you talk about this a lot. You know, fifth, sixth, seventh. KJ Wright was a fifth round pick. He had 250 tackles and was a 3-year starter at Mississippi State. Cam Chancellor was a fifth round pick. He was a 3-year starter at Virginia Tech with over 200 tackles and 6 picks. I mean, he was a really good player. Richard Sherman was an anomaly because he hated Jim Harbaugh, and Harbaugh wanted him out, so he booted him, and he played 1 year at corner, was a pretty productive starter for him in that 1 year. These are guys that were good, you know, good football players, good, you know, on the production sheet, you know, were really productive guys. And when you look at, like, gosh, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, so many of them are all just risk that really did very little in college. You know, Stephen Sullivan, Freddie Swain, and, you know, Alton Robinson had one good year. Like, at some point, where's KJ Hill? At some point, where's Prochet? At some point, where are these guys, right? Geno Stone from Iowa, that were good to great college players that may not, you know, project because of some of their physical limitations. But at some point, don't you need, and wouldn't it be nice to just kind of balance your draft with some of those guys that have been very, very good players? That's kind of where I'm left at times.
I'm looking at Harbaugh's setup that you talked about. So those are definitely a bunch of birdhouses. Is it possible it's Raven-related? Because Eric DaCosta, he's their GM, right?
Mm.
He's got a picture, like a painting of a Raven on his wall. Yeah. Is it like a bird theme because of the Ravens? Or do you think he just collects birdhouses?
I don't know.
Hey, he's a Harbaugh, man. Anything's possible.
Strange.
Who the heck knows?
Hey, give me a tidbit. Here's a little tidbit for you. Mel Kiper at 60, still going really strong, man.
Agreed. Even without McShay this year, he was great. Jeez.
He was a lot better, I thought, this year than he had been in a long time.
I agree with you.
Lewis Riddick sounds just fine. You know, does a good job as an opinion 3 days. Like both those guys, like, wow. Down, you know, a starter in Mayock and a huge contributor, both did good. Daniel Jeremiah is an absolute stud.
He's so good.
He is so stinking good. Even Dave Wyman, who mocks all of these dudes and called him Daniel Jemima for the last 3 months, even he yesterday or a Monday when I was listening to their afternoon show is like, okay, I've got to stop with the Daniel Jemima stuff because that dude knew every player, had just some sound reasoning and logic and fun at times. And I thought he had a great line talking about a long snapper that someone took like in the fifth round. And he said, I got to be honest, you know, I don't have much of a life, but I've got a life enough that I haven't studied a long snap. I'm sorry. Like, you know, I'm not that low of a life that I've got, you know, his snap times. And I know that drove Tessitore nuts, but, you know, I don't have everything on him, but everybody else. And his energy for 3 days was just for all those guys. And by the way, as you saw their setup, they don't have human interaction. They're not energized by the people around them, right? They're not picked up by, oh my gosh, the scene, the sights, the setting, let other people. He's staring at that camera for 6 hours on Thursday, on Friday, on Saturday. Trey Wingo as well. Like, what a yeoman's work by all of them. And I thought DJ just really stood out.
All right, some potpourri to talk through some of the other issues surrounding the draft, a non-Seahawks conversation, some other things going on in sports here, Brock. And I just kind of wanted to have that quick quarterback conversation as we watched quarterbacks get drafted. I mean, as you looked at situations, who do you project now going forward that you like their future as a quarterback in the NFL?
Well, I think Tua went to the right team. I would have made that pick at 5. I think that
it's to our point. Isn't it weird to see Miami having a good draft?
Well, they yes and no. They had so many picks, yeah. And actually there are a bunch of them that I thought were really bad that are developmental. And I said that to Mark Dominic the other night. I'm like, because after every pick, you know, we kind of talked, and then during breaks we would kind of like, hey, what do you really think of that? Gosh, I never thought that guy. But the number of times you're like, that's a project. And I said to it on the air, like, if you're the Dolphins, are you playing the long game here with so many of these draft picks thinking you're going to get, you know, develop them and be better in 2022? And to Mark's point, that's not the league.
Right.
You know, when you're a young coach and GM and you got to make your mark, you don't have 3 years to wait around. So they had a huge amount of picks. I like the tackle out of SC, Austin Jackson. I think Tua's the right guy to lead a group of young kind of players, which he did at Alabama, young stars. So, you know, I like that. I think Joe Burrow's perfect pick for Cincinnati. I mean, he's a hometown kid. Mm-hmm. If he can't do it with his just toughness and mental toughness and physical toughness, and, you know, he can't help them take the next step, then, you know, they're just going to continue to be mired where they are behind Pittsburgh and Baltimore in the AFC North. So,
how about Jordan Love and Aaron Rodgers?
Yeah, that makes no sense to me. And Jalen Hurts to Philly. Like, I don't get it, man.
It's funny, you know, man. And I people like both those guys, too.
Like both of them?
Yeah, I do. You know I like Jalen Hurts, and I don't know if there's ever going to be a star quarterback in the NFL. I think the accuracy and some of that is challenging for him.
Yep.
But I'd like him on my team. You know what I mean? Like, he's just a guy I want on my team. I love the personality. I love the leadership. Him, you know, there are guys who just do things that will stick with me forever. And yep. The way he handled getting benched at halftime of that.
No question.
That is one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And yep. To come back in the next year off the bench and really help his team win, it was such an incredible reward for what he had gone through. And then to have the kind of season he did at Oklahoma this year, I don't even like Oklahoma. I hate everything associated with Oklahoma. And yet, you know, I still like Jalen Hurts and rooted for him this year just because I like the guy. I don't mind that pick with Philadelphia, and I think they'll find a way to use him. And I'm not exactly sold on Carson Wentz, so I actually don't mind that one. The Jordan Love one is interesting. I think I understand what the Packers are doing, that they want to try to, you know, create the next quarterback so that they're not stuck with Aaron Rodgers and his attitude forever. I mean, the way he quit on his team against San Francisco in the playoffs last year, it was like everyone watching the draft didn't watch that. Did you not watch the guy quit on his team? It was a quarter into the game, and he was walking around like that game was over. That, you know what you do after that? Draft another quarterback, because Aaron Rodgers may not be the future of your franchise anymore if he's quitting in the first quarter of a playoff game. So yeah. Do I understand why they drafted Jordan Love? 100%. Yes, I do. That said, I thought Mina Kimes was dead on accurate, that a lot of the value in having a young quarterback today is that you get to those 4 years before you have to pay him, where you can, where you can. You're not going to get that because you've got dead money on Aaron Rodgers. Even if you got rid of him now, you'd be paying him $20 million a year over the next few years. So you're not going to get the true benefit of having that young quarterback who is great but has a cheap salary. So in that regard, it hurts the pick for me. But I honestly, did people not see Aaron Rodgers quit?
Yeah, he quit.
So to then go out and draft a quarterback, the Packers didn't do him dirty. They didn't do him wrong. They didn't Brett Favre him. He quit on them. And they went back out and drafted somebody else. And Aaron Rodgers, if you got a problem with that, and I know he hasn't necessarily said that he does, but I'll bet he does, because that's Aaron Rodgers' personality as far as we can tell. Look in the mirror, Aaron. You are the reason they drafted a quarterback this year. Go watch. You don't even have to watch the All-22s. Watch just the Fox film of you quitting on your team in the first quarter of a playoff game, of the NFC Championship game. You quit, and quit early. And for them to go out and draft a quarterback made perfect sense.
Well, maybe the premise does to find his future. I think Jordan Love is really inaccurate. He threw 17 picks this last season. Oh, he had new guys. It's still like you don't throw 17 interceptions in college. That's really that's pretty.
It's
pretty
a lot,
hard.
And I don't like the accuracy. I get that. I think he's a fun player, though.
And by the way, like if he quit on your team and it really gets bad and it's really hard and you really don't like him, you know what's coming? This is one of those things I think some of these teams fall into, especially with some new people, a new GM, a younger head coach. It's something John Schneider learned, I think, early on, and it said to us, like, hey, man, you can't just look at 2020 draft.
Right, just clear it out.
What's coming in 2021, Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence? Would I rather have what's coming down the pipe at quarterback, or am I going to, with that draft capital in this draft of a historic receivers and all the, you know, would I take Jordan Love? Like, no, I wouldn't.
That's very, very fair. And that maybe you just let the whole thing die and then you build it back up from the ashes. So, yeah, I can understand that. But, you know, I also understand this guy quit on me and I'm just going to go get the best quarterback we think we can get. And if I can't get the guys at the very top of the draft, then I'll get Love. And maybe they think they just like something they saw.
You know what else is going to be kind of nice? To spin it back to Seattle. Once again, Seattle will be nowhere near the headlines for all those years. Maybe that's good. Maybe it's bad. I don't know. Maybe Pete will try to do what he can to just kind of create it because he loves it. He loves being, you know, and not in a negative way. He wants to be the star. He wants to be on the stage. But the cameras and the headlines, and when this all gets going further, like, they're going to be in Green Bay and they're going to be in Philadelphia. Right, that Philadelphia fan base, that Philadelphia media base, going to do all it can to put a wedge between Hurts and Wentz and a second round pick. And you know that's already coming.
I think that's going to be fun. I'm kind of looking forward to that. Yeah. I think Wentz is a little overrated also. And then you get to Buffalo, where they drafted Fromm late. And I know
Jake Fromm.
I was thinking Brian Brome. This is Jake Fromm.
Yes.
I also liked Brian Brome. That didn't work out either. But Jake Fromm.
I think it was also Brom.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, whatever. It should have been Brome. Whatever. Okay.
It looks like Brohm, B-R-O-H-M.
When, Brock, will there be a legitimate quarterback controversy in Buffalo, and will it be now?
Oh, you mean when the starter sprains his MCL and in comes Fromm, and maybe they're 2-2 or 3-1, and Fromm, because it's an awesome roster with a really good draft, and Tom Brady's no longer in your division, and all of a sudden Fromm goes like 6-0? And they're, or 5-1, or, you know, and they're 8-2, then what happens? Then what happens? Are you going to make the move back to your first round pick and your top 10 pick and Josh Allen? Or do you kind of like what Fromm did, you know, when he unseated a 5-star rocket arm QB down in Georgia and didn't look back and ran off Justin Fields and others? Like, everyone, you know, I kind of enjoyed your tweet about Fromm.
There's going to be a
quarterback controversy. Fromm would have been, I don't know if I would have taken him necessarily ahead of Jordan Love, and I wouldn't have done what the Packers did for Jake Fromm, but when he was sitting there in like the third or the fourth round for the New Orleans Saints,
that guy's good.
somebody
you know
to back
good?
Up Drew Brees and to fit in that system where you don't need a rocket arm and you're a winner and you're tough as hell and people love you and you've ran off Eason and you've ran off Justin Fields and you played for Kirby Smart.
You were overcomplicating this. Don't overcomplicate it. The current quarterback in Buffalo is bad. Jake Fromm was drafted. He will eventually there. Brock, this is what's coming. You know it.
Quarterback controversy.
That doesn't really have a Buffalo sound to it necessarily, but mark my words, it will be coming. Their quarterback's bad. Fromm has a legacy. He is. Stop shaking your head, Kyle. He's not good. He's inaccurate. And by the way, he runs around like a maniac, exposing himself to injury, and he will get hurt. And then guess what's going to happen? This kid's going to come in, and he's going to be better because he's not going, because he's going to be able to actually throw the ball to the wide receivers. Who did they pick up in the offseason? What was the big offseason addition they had in Buffalo?
Stephon Diggs.
Stephon Diggs seems like a pretty patient guy, right? When Josh Allen throws the ball 30 yards past him, he's going to be totally cool with that, right? When he's wide open and Allen decides to tuck it and run and get blasted for a 4-yard gain, I'm sure Stephon Diggs is going to be totally cool with that.
He will be cool with that because he's better than Kirk Cousins, who underthrows him by 20 yards. You'd rather have Josh Allen overthrow you.
Week one,
at least when you're Stephon Diggs, you want a quarterback that can get you the ball, baby.
Week two, sure.
What's up, Kyle? How are you,
dude? What's up, big dog? I'm just over here listening to this. Jake Fromm's going to be anything. Jake Fromm is Matt Flynn. He's Chase Daniel. He is like the most generic NFL backup quarterback of all time.
Totally agree.
That dude will win you a one preseason game and like do nothing else ever.
You think this is about Jake Fromm? It's not. Their current quarterback's awful. He can't play.
I'm not going to debate you on that. I'm just here to say it ain't going to be Jake Fromm.
In Buffalo, by next year, Jake Fromm is under center and Josh Allen is behind him as a running back. Because that's essentially what he is.
He's like a Peyton Hillis H-back.
Yes. He's like the pachyderm.
Yeah, okay. There
he's
you go.
Like the big pachyderm. All right.
Well, I'll tell you, if you're Fromm, you didn't love seeing millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars just dissipate as you sat there with your family in Warner Robins, Georgia, very comfortably with your brothers, your mom, and your dad. And by the way, one of the top lines of the whole draft, because Titus, of course, had to watch every minute of it. And they showed Fromm in Little League. I forget what his nickname was then because he was about the same size at 12. Titus goes, gosh, he's built like me. Like on his Little League team, like, that looks like me out there. Yeah. I'm like, yep, sure does, buddy. I think you'll be taller than 6'1", though.
Well,
because I think Fromm stopped at about 13. But he ended up in the perfect spot. He watched millions of dollars dissipate. He ended up in the perfect spot with a run, play defense team.
Bro. Oh, no, sorry.
What's that?
No, yeah, Fromm's 6'1". Tell me about Jacob Eason, because that's the name you're immediately going to get, you know, when you start talking Fromm. Eason's one of the guys, right, that he beat out. So.
Yep.
What
I can't say I was surprised. I really can't. I didn't think that he was going to go in the first. Everybody had him in the top 60 or so in the second. I thought maybe the end of the second. I thought he'd probably go by the third round. But I can't say that I was surprised to kind of sit and watch that unfold with very few teams. Kurt Warner said it on the broadcast a bunch. Like, this isn't a league that needs, 10 new quarterbacks. The ones that had the dire need got him at 1, 5, and 6. Green Bay took a risk, and then you started to look at teams. I thought maybe Jacksonville, but remember also Cam Newton and Jameis Winston are sitting out there. Looks like Jameis is going to go to New Orleans on a 1-year deal, but they should have put those two names, in my opinion, right there with Jacob Eason and Jake Fromm as guys that teams are making decisions on.
Jacksonville doesn't have a need at quarterback, Brock. Let's just be clear. So, next!
Yeah.
Weren't you hoping that Eason was going to go there and that they were going to compete for that job?
The Apple Cup of the battle? Sure.
I was definitely kind of hoping that something like that would happen.
Well,
would
they're getting a Battle of the Palouse now. They drafted Jake Luton. So the former Idaho Vandal. So
it'll be
the cross-border rivalry now. Don't worry about that.
Great.
Battle of the Palouse playing out in Duval.
Yeah, but I felt bad for Jacob, But I just was not shocked, you know. And in talking to his team kind of through this process and early in the process, they said, no, he doesn't have to be a first-round pick. You know, if he goes in the second to, you know, a quality organization or whatever, it may be better for him. He doesn't go in the second. He doesn't go in the third. He ends up in the fourth. Jacoby Brissett's there. Now, what do they do with Jacoby Brissett? Right? I mean, I think that's the next domino to fall. If they trade him to New England or maybe he goes to Jacksonville or whatever, then you're like, okay, that's a great fit. If Jacoby Brissett is still there, Issa may be on the practice squad. I mean, that may be a legitimate conversation. You know?
Does he quit if that's the case?
No. Nope. And, you know, he's gonna be up against it. I will say this, personality wise, Frank Reich and Phillip Rivers in Indianapolis, all pretty good fits for Jacob.
It was not a banner 3 days for the University of Washington.
Not at all.
Nope. Yeah, I mean, the whole Pac-12 was embarrassed.
But especially the Huskies.
For the UW, it was bad. And I can understand why. I mean, you kind of look through over the last few years, even when the teams have been very good and some really top-notch players, who's really worked out in the pros?
Yep. I mean,
it has not been...
Buda Baker.
Yeah, Buda's been good. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying they're all bad players, but is there a star that came out of that list? Vita Vea might end up being
it's
that.
Funny, it's funny, it's like really good Corey year. Littleton is the best, mm-hmm. arguably, and he came out of nowhere.
I mean, you know, a lot of the guys who were the best players on those teams, they haven't done a whole lot.
Yep.
So, you know, for the league to not trust UW guys right now, I don't know that I blame them.
Well, I've been sitting on this. I'll give you
something. I think the Seahawks, by the way, got the best. If I could have one guy off that UW team this year, the Seahawks got the guy I would have wanted, Aaron Fuller.
Yeah.
That's one guy I would have wanted. You can have the rest of them. That guy's, I like the way he competes.
Well, I will say this, and I was going to share this little takeaway, and I've been kind of sitting and teasing you guys. You've not heard this yet, but keep an eye on this with where things are and the climate we're in now. And again, this was something I heard kind of off air regarding the draft. The supplemental draft in July, remember the supplemental draft? It's always like a non-starter. We talk about it for one day on our show, like, oh, I wonder if anybody's going to get picked in the supplemental draft. If we get to July, all right, in mid to late July, and the NFL is looks like it's going to find a way to play, and whether it's in half-filled stadiums or no stadiums to begin or whatever, but they're pushing, and they're going to play, and college football looks like it may not play, and especially out west, that supplemental draft could be a very, very different draft than it's ever been before.
Guys,
the Elijah Moldens, the Levi Onwuzurikes, the Paulson Adebos, the Walker Littles, the number of Oregon Duck juniors that came back to school for senior year. If they're not going to play football, just you know, keep an eye on that, because that could, you know, I had one kind of executive say that, like, you know, you think you're done and, oh, we had the draft and, you know, these last tier free agents. Well, if college football is not going to play, and you're all of those names that I just listed who went back to school to play your final year, or, you know, you didn't want to, Travis Etienne at Clemson, the running back, right? These are all draft eligible guys who looked at it and said, eh, you know what? I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to put myself in a little better position as a senior. You know, they may just look at it and go, no college football, I'm out. And that supplemental draft, and as far as creating and keeping cap space and being very aggressive and being bigger than it's ever been in the history of the supplemental draft, just keep an eye on that come July.
Kyle, what do you think of John Harbaugh's birdhouses?
Unexpected. I mean, that was the really thing that stood out. I see Jack Harbaugh doing that, but not John. No.
So, Kyle, you missed Salk's take. You had a really hot take. What do you think Salk's take was on Cliff Kingsbury's house?
That it wasn't his.
Oh, that's another good
that
take.
The Cardinals rented him that house for draft weekend.
And it probably cost nothing.
Just so that it would put on the appearance that they're the young,
like,
cool, hip place.
We are in Scottsdale. Yep. Look at us. Look at our coach.
Our coach has a poolside bar at his own house.
A cool nickname if you wanted to. Maybe you could come up with one. He's deserving.
That's a good take. Very
plausible,
that's a good, by the way.
Kyle, good take. That was not his take. What do you think? What was 1B of Salk's take on that Kingsbury house?
Did it tie into Bruce Arians? Was it like, was he captive there?
No.
Was Bruce Arians in the background letting him know that Cliff Kingsbury is not going anywhere?
No.
I don't know.
It wasn't that either. No, dude, the people were going on and on about how great that house was. It's so nice.
Oh, well, that it wasn't?
No, it's just Phoenix. That house cost like $150,000.
I was not a fan of the like square footage AstroTurf or whatever.
Yeah, that was
like,
a strange
what's the point
deal.
Of that? I
that
don't
house
need
is
that.
Like Joel's house. I mean,
like,
meh. They're all like that. That's what houses look like there. They give houses like that away when you get there. Just don't be sweating Cliff Kingsbury. All he does is live in Scottsdale. That's fine. Hey, last thing here, and then we'll get out of here. The Last Dance documentary. So episodes 3 and 4 were this weekend. I've really enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I was, you know, like most, I don't know whether all sports fans are like this. I've had my favorite players and teams, and I generally hate everybody else.
Oh, right? Really?
So does that make sense? So, like, that's
is
who
that
I am.
A nudist? Is it, love and by the way, you. Kyle, it's Salk's 42nd birthday today, so he's making a bunch of these discoveries.
Well, I don't think that's...
Did you just figure that out about yourself?
No, I've known this forever.
Forever.
Oh.
It's one of the things that Mike and I share in common. Right. We generally like sports because it's
Do you
one
like
chance
Michael Jordan? No.
To acceptably hate other people.
I hate Michael Jordan. Why? Because he beat the Lakers, and I was a huge Laker fan as a kid. I hated the Celtics. I hated the Jazz. I hated everybody because I loved the Lakers. The only team I could kind of be okay with of teams that were good in the 80s and 90s were the Pistons because they beat the Celtics, and I admired that because I hated the Celtics so much. So as a kid growing up, as great as Michael Jordan was, I didn't like him. I didn't root for him because Magic Johnson and James Worthy, those are my favorite players on my favorite team as a kid. That's what meant something to me. So it's always hard for me to kind of get out of that. But I've been able to kind of watch this Jordan documentary as just fascinating to see him as a person and everybody around him. I didn't know all the history. Like, I didn't know the history from week one of him hurting his foot. And the way they came in with like specific time limits for him. I didn't know any of that. I thought that was a really interesting way of foreshadowing the problems that were to come with him and Krause and the rest of the group. So I've been really fixated and watching. I love it.
So you've had this discovery about yourself that you hate everybody else, but your teams.
But
okay. I have discovered through 10 years of doing sports radio, there's a few things that were injected into me that are still there that that are now just habitual, that I watch so many of these things and have to spin it back to Seattle. Because so often we took these things in on the outside and we're like, okay, how do we make that relevant in Seattle? How do we make that a topic that we talk about? So I find now, sadly, that almost everything I watch, I still have that same mindset.
Well, I'm going to hope then, because I talked about this with Tom, Jake, and Stacey last week. I'm going to assume that one of those things, because this is one that I had, I'm going to assume that you had this also, that watching Jordan's look of disgust with his teammates in, I think it was the second episode of the first week, when they just couldn't like get anything right in 98, and he's just like, ugh, I'll just do it myself. And his whole face falls and he just like drives to the basket. That you compared that to Russell Wilson being exactly the opposite after the missed field goal in the Arizona game.
To a degree, yes. Yes. I had two thoughts. That's one of them. And I took it a little different in that Russ's favorite players growing up, his sports icons and idols are MJ and Jeter. And yet he has none of that personality trait.
None.
He has none to attack teammates or hold them accountable. He has none where he's going to get in the face of guys. Like, you know, those are the two that he loved. And usually if those are the ones you watch growing up, you kind of imitate them, right? Not, and you're going to take on some of that trait. Now, both of those guys also, like Russell in this way, didn't always, you know, portray that, right? They wanted the perception to be a little different. But behind the scenes, as we are seeing, those, and especially Jordan, grinded on guys. And Russell has never done that. The other takeaway is Phil and Pete are spirit animals. They're hippies of the same, from the same teepee, man.
That's
like
true.
They are, it's, and I kind of knew that about Phil, but seeing behind the scenes and also seeing the X's and O's, and like Pete Carroll had Bud Grant and Monty Kiffin and these guys, Phil Jackson had Tex Winters. So even though he's a hippie, like in a new age guy and totally different, I'm going to lock arms with, you know, Tex Winters, and I'm going to lock arms with Bud Grant and Monty Kiffin, and I'm going to know these X's and O's so well. But then I'm going to deal with crazy Rodman, and I can deal with crazy Marshawn and have that same character trait. So, yeah, kind of remarkable to watch, you know, some of the behind the scenes with Phil. That's what I've loved.
What do you make of the whole Isaiah thing?
I was never a big Isaiah guy.
I know, but what do you make of that argument? I mean, do you, as you watch it and you hear Isaiah say, look, that's what was done. The Celtics did it to us the year before. It wasn't the era of sports radio judging every single thing you did. We just walked off the field because we were, or the court, because we were disgusted, versus Jordan saying, no, I shook hands, and that's what you're supposed to do. What do you make of all that? It's a fascinating.
Well, I think in that case, when Jordan, who got the tar beat out of him, right, by those teams, had the resolve to shake their hands and give them their due, and then you don't do that to him when he comes up, when little brother finally beats you, you're going to be a little baby. You're going to be a brat like that. And they said, wow, that's what Larry Bird and the Celtics did. You would know that, Salk. You studied the Celtics of the 80s. Did they do that?
Yeah, and they showed the video right in the documentary.
Now, they said that was for security purposes. Is that a myth?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what you've heard from Celtics people and some of those guys, like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Pretty easy, you know, like, let's
slow the
roll.
But that doesn't mean
that's
how Isaiah interpreted it at the time. I mean, yeah. Even if that is the case and there's truth to that, if you're Isaiah, you're like, man, these guys walked off the court. Okay, I guess that's how it's done.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can kind of go both ways.
I hated Bill Laimbeer. I'm not like you and Howdy. I didn't hate everybody, but man, Laimbeer.
Of course. Laimbeer's the worst, right? And the fact that he's the one who suggests they all walk off the court makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But the fact that Isaiah sells him out on it also makes perfect sense. Isaiah is the worst. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And it's easy to side with Jordan in this one because one of them is Michael Jordan and the other is Isaiah Thomas. And Thomas is so obnoxious. And he's been such a failure in every other part of life other than his ability to be a basketball player that it makes perfect sense to just side against him in whatever argument is happening. Yeah. But I do think there is something interesting to just that.
Oh.
There is the level of hatred that existed then between teams that I miss. And
will we ever be able to have it
in
again?
No sport. You'll never get it again in any sport.
You don't think so?
No, never. It will never happen again in any major sport ever. I mean, maybe MMA or something like that, individual sport, but never. No, in pro team sports, you will never get hatred between teams the way you did then because of the way free agency and agents and training said it's just changed the game. And guys like Jordan changed it in some ways by instituting that level of, no, we're going to be respectful at the end. Now, hockey gets this right where, yeah, you do shake hands, but it doesn't mean you have to stop hating them, right? And so, like, you can take a number and know, I'm going to fight that guy next year, but it's not going to be at the end of the series because I can't do it now. I'm going to shake his hand because that's the classy thing to do. And next year, I'm going to pummel his face, right? I mean, like, that I love that element of hockey, of that need to hold on to your temper, knowing that you're going to get to fight him some other day. So, no, I don't think, you think we're ever going to see that level of anger and hatred again? No way.
I don't want to say never, ever. You just never know how things are going to turn. We never know how this is going to look on the other side, coming out of what we just kind of have come out of and are still obviously in the midst of, but economically and what these leagues are going to look like and all these things that we thought for sure were just set in stone and this is the way it's always going to be. I don't know. This experience of the last few months has kind of shown us that you just never really fully know. But I totally understand where you're coming from. It's hard to imagine in this day and age turning back the clock to, I mean, Haley and Macy were watching that and they were like flinching. They're like, they got to punch each other.
Oh, so great.
Like, I play basketball. It's, they were so, body slamming each other. So they got great to do that.
It's so great, yes, man. That brand of, maybe the Knicks ruined it for everybody, but it was so much more fun to watch that than it is now. It's just night and day. And in football, it hasn't been enough to make me stop watching, but in basketball it has. And I miss that level of competition and the way those teams went after each other. All right, this has been fun. Fun talking draft with you. We will be back next week, obviously, for more. Thank you for the birthday wishes. I appreciate it. And we will be back with you guys next week. Until then,
he's in the 42-year-old barn.
See everybody.
Get to the chopper!